Hello, I'm Will Seaman, and this is a special KABU public affairs feature focus on Israel-Palestine. This series of special programs looks back on the highly publicized Israeli withdrawal from Gaza. Leading up to and during the withdrawal, international news organizations provided sustained coverage. Interviews and special features reporting focused on the experience and anguish of Israeli settlers. The images beamed out of Gaza showed unarmed Israeli soldiers removing settlers, dramatic scenes of soldiers embracing settlers, often in tears, a message of emotion and grief at the final end to the Israeli settler presence in Gaza. Is there more to this story? We are very fortunate to have with us today, from his home in Jerusalem, the Israeli anthropologist Professor Jeff Halper. Jeff Halper is coordinator of the Israeli Committee Against House Demolitions. He teaches at Ben-Gurion University, and he is author of many articles and essays on the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, among them the valuable book Obstacles to Peace, A Critical Tour of the Jerusalem-West Bank Interface. Jeff Halper, thank you for joining us today.
You're welcome. Good to be with you.
Well, I thought as you, through your work with the Israeli Committee Against House Demolitions, you have, among Israelis, perhaps the greatest knowledge and experience of the destruction of homes in the occupied territories, the destruction of Palestinian homes. As you watch the images of the Israeli settlers being removed from Gaza and then the bulldozers leveling the houses, leveling entire communities, what were your thoughts? What do you think people needed to know about this story that they perhaps were not getting from the media coverage of recent weeks?
Well, you know, one of the images that, or one of the, I don't know, all right, images that crossed my mind all the time was that of autism, in a sense. I mean, how autistic we were, and we are. You know, the whole thing had to do with us. It's us, 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 and there's nothing else. There's no Palestinians. There's no human beings. You know, the phrase the settlers picked was, Jews don't expel Jews. The whole thing had to do with the Jewish suffering and Jewish that, and how the Jews lost their homes, and how the Jews are being expelled, and how the Jews have suffered now, with absolutely no sense of where they are, that they're not even in the state of Israel. These are people that settled outside the boundaries of their own country and claimed those lands of their own. These are people who have caused the demolition of thousands of Palestinian homes with not one tear shed, homes that they could see from their own patios that were there one day and gone the next so that their life could be more secure. You know, the destruction of the entire Palestinian economy in Gaza, that we left a scorched earth. 1.5 million people almost left absolutely impoverished. None of that concerned anybody. It was all us, our suffering, our hopes, our houses, our struggles, our this and that. And it really was autistic from the point of view of not seeing anything else except ourselves. And in some ways, ironically, that's the way the media covered it. I think every settler in Gaza must have been interviewed twice by almost every news organization. But who covered the Palestinians? I mean, it was such a colonial exercise in news coverage that really mirrored the autism of the settlers and of Israeli society that it was really an amazing thing to see in the 21st century.
Wonder if we could look at the history of this colonial presence in Gaza. Why were those settlers there in the first place? We hear, for example, of the fact that Gaza is one of the most densely populated regions on the planet. The settlers were outnumbered. I don't even know what the ratio was, but
the settlers were half percent of the population.
And this brings to mind what's euphemistically referred to as the demographic problem. Why were those settlers in Gaza in the first place? Why did the State of Israel decide to create settlements in the Gaza Strip?
Well, it wasn't exactly what the State of Israel decided. There was a lot of settler pressure already after the Six-Day War and in the early 1970s. And then, of course, when the Begin government came to power in 1977, then with Sharon as the architect of the settlement enterprise, then a decision was taken at a governmental level to systematically colonize or systematically incorporate Judea, Samaria, which is the West Bank, and Gaza into the State of Israel. It was never done. Annexation never happened. They've always remained occupied territories in the eyes of the world. But in a sense, there was really one reason for the people being in Gaza, and that is a claim to the land of Israel. Even though the claim was very shaky, because there are many, many rabbis that say, you know, Gaza is not a part of the land of Israel. The land of Israel kind of shades off when you get down to Beersheba. And in fact, in the biblical story, if you want that as a reference, when Abraham exiled or expelled Hagar and Ishmael at Sarah's behest, they went to Beersheba. And in Beersheba, that was because that was outside of the land of Israel, and that's where God promised Ishmael that he would make him also the father of a great people, you know, the Arab people. So that even in this biblical story, Gaza is really Arab territory. It is not the land of Israel, which seems arcane. But in fact, that was the reason why Begin, who was the most fervent supporter of the greater land of Israel, was able to give up Sinai to Egypt in the agreement, because it wasn't the land of Israel. So Gaza really has a very different status, even from a religious point of view, than the West Bank does, which is really the heart of the land of Israel. And that, but nevertheless, you know, settlers always make up their stories. And so the idea was, well, that's where the prophet Isaiah had been for a period of time, and it is a part of the land, and it has very nice beaches at any rate. So that over the years, I think the settler presence and this claim to the land of Israel through Gaza became more and more established. But it's really a part of a wider colonization effort of Israel to take over the entire country from the Mediterranean to the Jordan River.
Well, you sort of hinted at the character of the settler presence in Gaza. You've spent some time there and experienced the destruction of Palestinian homes. Could you talk some more about the character of the Israeli colonial presence in Gaza?
Well, you know, they were about 7,000 to 8,000 settlers living among almost 1.5 million Palestinians. But that handful of settlers actually occupied 20% of the Gaza Strip, including most of the coastline and most of the water. And not only that, but with the army presence around, the Israeli presence was over 40% of the west of Gaza, which meant that the 1.5 million Palestinians were really confined to impoverished areas on only 60% of this tiny, tiny Gaza Strip. So that the inequalities were absolutely astounding. But the settlers essentially set up very closed communities. They could see Palestinians as kind of background, but over the years, as Israel demolished all the houses around the settlements, gradually, you know, the landscape, if you did look outside, became more and more desolate. But within these settlements, even though this is sand dunes, you had green lawns, you had, you know, beautiful beaches, suburban-style, red-tile-roofed houses, tremendous expanses of greenhouses and agriculture. So, in fact, the settlers actually used a lot of the water of the Gaza Strip. You know, the aquifers in the Gaza Strip are dangerously low. The Palestinians have only polluted, brackish water to drink. And so the settlers, who got a lot of their water from inside Israel itself, used a lot of the aquifer water in Gaza for agriculture that simply wasn't appropriate in the sand dune area near the ocean where they were doing their farming. You know, they had a huge flower industry in the desert, so that it was an ecologically inappropriate experiment. It took tremendous amounts of land from a very impoverished and densely packed population. It used the resources, which, according to international law, is forbidden. The Fourth Geneva Convention says not only are you prohibited from moving your population into an occupied territory, which Israel has done in its settlements in the West Bank and East Jerusalem and Gaza, but you're also prohibited to use the resources of an occupied territory. On the contrary, an occupying power is required by international law to safeguard the well-being of the native population under its control, which Israel certainly hasn't done in the case of the Palestinians. So that the settlers created this paradise, you know, this beautiful kind of southern Florida-type, grassy, beautiful area by the beach. Their kids were all expert surfers and so on. while the Palestinians were reduced to absolute dismal poverty and lost about probably between 2,500 and 4,000 houses have been systematically demolished in Gaza by the Israeli army for the sake of the settlements.
And we're not.
So it's a very dismal picture.
And we're not just talking about Palestinian houses as well. For example, when I was there in the summer of 2003, I was shown what had been a citrus orchard that had only recently been destroyed. What about that? What about the agricultural lands of Palestinians that have met a similar fate?
You know, Israel has left all the occupied territories absolutely scorched earth. Since 1967, Israel has uprooted or cut down more than a million fruit and olive trees in the occupied territories, including, you're right, including whole tracts of especially orange trees and other kinds of fruit trees in Gaza. It's destroyed completely the agriculture in Gaza, which was a main source of export. The fishermen in Gaza also aren't even allowed to fish, hardly. They can only go 1 mile out in certain very restricted areas into the sea, whereas Israel claims for its own fishermen a 12-mile strip in the Mediterranean for them to fish. So on every level, economic and physical and spiritual, you might say, it's been an absolute, I mean, one of the worst examples of oppression, just outright oppression with no redeeming value, with no redeeming ideology, I think, in modern history. And yet the settlers were all portrayed as these nice, normal people, just your average Joe neighbor. You know, all they want to do is water their lawns and make a living and, you know, have nothing against their Palestinian neighbors, the salt of the earth people. And therefore, all the sympathy goes to them without either them nor the media paying any attention whatsoever to the absolute destruction of a whole society. And I want to say one more thing. This isn't only a Palestinian society of Gaza. Most of the people in Gaza are refugees. So these are people that have been driven out of their houses once before by Israel. Some of them have had their houses demolished. If we go back to 56 when Israel took Gaza, if we go back to 67 when Israel took Gaza, Sharon demolished more than 2,000 homes in Gaza in the early 1970s when he was the southern commander. So we're talking about refugees, victims of Israel, who were driven from their homes and lands inside Israel, who have had the shacks that they have occupied in the meantime demolished two or three times or more since then. So that it's not simply a population that Israel has oppressed, it's a population that Israel has serially oppressed since 1948. And you would think that Israel would have a special responsibility or even a special sense of guilt towards that population, which it doesn't.
The explanation that we hear again and again is that all of these measures taken against the Palestinian community, the destruction of homes, the destruction of orchards, has to do with security. How do you respond to those who believe very fervently, of course, that if there were only an end to Palestinian violence, all of these terrible things that are granted are awful, but they would not be necessary if it weren't for the Palestinian violence? How do you respond to that kind of understanding of the situation?
Well, that would be true if there was no occupation. If we were talking about communities inside the state of Israel, where people are really living in their homes inside Israel, going about their everyday lives, you know, and they were simply being attacked, there would be something to that. I mean, there is terrorism and there are security concerns that are legitimate, but we're not. We're talking about an occupation. We're talking about people living in other people's lands. This is not the state of Israel. And we're talking about a very oppressive presence. I don't think it's right to expect the Palestinians either to sit back and watch their lives being destroyed by a handful of settlers and simply, what, accept that? No person would do that. So that, you know, the whole security issue is really, it has to be put in the context of occupation. You know, the answer to security, Israel's security, the security of all of citizens will come when there is a Palestinian state alongside Israel, when the Palestinians have the same rights, then, and this has been said over and over again by the Palestinian leadership, then there'll be security, because you'll have taken away the grievances. You've created, you've given the Palestinians at least some stake, some viable state of their own. But as long as there's occupation, I think it's absolutely impossible, ridiculous even, even immoral for Israel to expect that their own people will live in security while other people are being, having their houses destroyed and are being killed. You know, there's been three times more Palestinians killed than Israelis. And of course, the issue of terror is, you know, if you adopt human rights language, which is very important, human rights language is universal. Human rights language says all violence against civilians is prohibited, whether it's Palestinians putting on a suicide belt like today in Beersheba and blowing themselves up, that's absolutely prohibited in international law. But also where Israelis drop one-ton bombs on apartment buildings in Gaza City, that's also prohibited. So I think if we move to a human rights perspective rather than a kind of a self-serving Israeli one, we'll find that Israeli terrorism is just as bad as Palestinian terrorism. And in fact, and this is what the states have to learn as well, the solution to terrorism and the achievement of security does not come from a win-lose option. It comes when everybody's grievances are addressed, which means that there has to be a true peace between Israel and the Palestinians. And Gaza is not that. Gaza was absolutely a unilateral withdrawal in a way, but it was a kind of a redeployment rather than a disengagement. And it is not a peace process, and it's not a recipe for addressing Israel's security needs.
I'd like to turn to your perspective on what has led to this withdrawal, given that there are a number of different explanations. I'm just going to throw out a few here. One, of course, is that this is a result of the militant resistance by Palestinians within Gaza. Another being that this is a diversion from a consolidation of the hold on the West Bank, and in fact an expansion on settlements in the West Bank. Another recently that the United States played a role in terms of increased pressure, this being linked to the decline of the Bush administration's fortunes in Iraq and the need to provide a kind of an alternative view of U.S. foreign policy with respect to the Israel-Palestine conflict. What do you think led to this change, and how substantial is it? If these settlements have been removed, doesn't that create some kind of opening for Palestinians within the Gaza Strip?
Well, I would go actually with option B. You know, Sharon and his advisors and Israel's political leaders have been very explicit about why Israel left. There's no mystery here. They have said very well that withdrawal from Gaza is what the head of Sharon's office called the formaldehyde of the peace process. In other words, the only flashpoint between Israel and the Palestinians was in Gaza. That was the only place of fighting. The West Bank, because of the tremendous Israeli presence, because of the wall that's being built and so on, the West Bank has been more quiet. And so the idea is that if we can eliminate this flashpoint in Gaza, then the entire conflict becomes quiet. I mean, Gaza was the only scene of hot conflict. It becomes quiet. It drops off the front pages. And then Israel can quietly consolidate its hold on the West Bank and East Jerusalem with no timetable. In other words, Israel can go ahead and consolidate its settlement blocks, which it's doing. The day after the Gaza disengagement, Israel announced that it's building a wall around the Maale Adumim settlement that encompasses half the width of the West Bank, which absolutely destroys any possibility of a viable Palestinian state. So it's very clear on the ground and in Israeli declarations what was going on here. We sacrificed Gaza, which isn't strategic anyway. There was no future for those settlements anyway. It was really untenable. So we sacrificed that in order to consolidate our hold on East Jerusalem and the West Bank and the settlement block. And I think it's very clear, and it's been said, and there's no mystery to it.
What, though, in spite of perhaps those motivations for the Sharon government's shift in terms of withdrawing from Gaza, what, though, are the prospects for something emerging out of this, if we can we call it, for example, a newly liberated territory for the Palestinian people, or is that not the way to understand what's happening now in Gaza?
That's not the way to understand it. First of all, Sharon has said very explicitly that there is no linkage between Gaza and the West Bank. As a matter of fact, Sharon said the other day, in response to Condoleezza Rice, that Gaza will be the last Israeli withdrawal. Israel has an interest in creating a Palestinian state on pieces of the West Bank because it has to get rid of almost 4 million Palestinians living in the occupied territories. It wants a Palestinian state in order to relieve itself of that population, but a state that's small enough and weak enough that it leaves Israel in control, actually, of the entire country. That's where we're going. Now, that has to be unilateral. The withdrawal from Gaza, it's crucial to understand that the withdrawal from Gaza was not done through negotiations. It wasn't through any peace process. It wasn't in the framework of the roadmap. It was a unilateral act on the part of Israel, absolutely for its own interest. And the interest is, like I said, to eliminate that flashpoint. Now, whatever will come next will be another series of unilateral steps on the part of Israel. Israel has nothing to offer the Palestinians. All it can offer them is a Bantustan-type little truncated mini-state. There's nothing to talk about with the Palestinians. So that Israel is going to go ahead in finishing its wall, because the wall really represents not a security barrier, but the wall represents a new political boundary, even a demographic boundary that incorporates the major settlement blocks. So Israel will continue with building the wall. It'll continue to consolidate the settlement blocks. It will incorporate into Israel itself those parts of Jerusalem and the West Bank that it wants for its own control. And then the rest, which is pretty much barren land, it'll give to a Palestinian state. So that we're not in a peace process. We're in a process of Israel unilaterally deciding what is going to remain with Israel and what we will give to the Palestinians, again, in this kind of a mini-state that gets them off our hands but leaves us in control. And it's not a peace process. It's certainly not negotiations. I believe Israel will do everything to avoid the roadmap, because the roadmap certainly brings Europe and the UN into the equation that Israel does not want. And so we're really, for all the kudos that Sharon got for the withdrawal from Gaza, in fact, it was a complete runaround, a bypassing of the only diplomatic initiative on the agenda, which is the roadmap. And the roadmap calls on Israel in the first stage to stop demolishing homes and to stop building settlements, neither of which it's done. So you see, it's created this unilateral kind of a step in order to allow itself unilaterally to consolidate its own borders and its own position, and eventually it'll create a fait accompli and avoid negotiations completely with the Palestinians, with American compliance, of course.
I want to give you a chance to turn to issues that you think an American audience needs to hear. Mm-hmm. But I want to have you touch on just one dimension of this that I think has caused a tremendous amount of confusion, especially for people in this country, in the United States. Mm-hmm. And that is the destruction of the communities, the Israeli settlements. Why were the buildings destroyed? Why were the greenhouses destroyed? Was this just a kind of a vindictiveness, or was there something deeper in terms of that decision?
No, it's very simple. The houses were demolished by agreement with the Palestinians, because the Palestinians have almost, like I said, 1.5 million people living in tremendously crowded areas in desperate need of housing. And Israel's demolished thousands of houses in Gaza. And the suburban-type, sprawling, little one-story ranch-style settler homes amidst, a lot of grass and land, simply didn't, it doesn't meet the Palestinian needs. They can't. They have nothing to do with that very low-density housing. And so the agreement was that Israel would demolish the homes and that the rubble would be used for rebuilding really what have to be much more dense housing projects on that land for Palestinians. So in some ways, that really did meet the needs of the Palestinians more than giving them these dormitory suburbs that they couldn't use. The greenhouses were purchased. Actually by some Jewish figures pitched in. Wolfson, who was Bush's envoy to Gaza, the former head of the World Bank, he pitched in $500,000, and they raised about $50 million to give to the settlers in order to purchase the greenhouses for Palestinian use. So that part of it is less problematic. So just to turn for a second to what Americans should know, and don't know, is that in April of 2004, the Bush administration agreed that Israel annex the major settlement blocks in the West Bank to Israel, including East Jerusalem. About 20 to 25% of the West Bank was formally accepted by the Bush administration as now being a part of Israel, which completely, again, violates the roadmap, which talks about ending the occupation and forecloses a viable Palestinian state. And what Americans really don't know is that that annexation was approved by Congress in June of 2004 in the House by a vote of 407-9. So it was virtually unanimous. A few members of the Black Caucus and Dennis Kucinich and Ron Paul were among the nine that voted against annexation. Otherwise, it's absolutely bipartisan, Democrats and Republicans together. And the annexation of the settlement blocks to Israel was approved by the Senate the next day by a vote of 95-3, where the only senator that voted against annexation on principle was Byrd of West Virginia, who is being vilified today by AIPAC as a Ku Klux Klan member, a Nazi, you name it. So that this shift in American policy of actually allowing Israel to annex the parts of the West Bank it wants to and foreclosing a viable Palestinian state, which contradicts the roadmap entirely, is something the American public doesn't know. And it goes way beyond the Bush administration because the Democrats are complicit in this. In other words, Congress is Israel's trump card. Whenever it gets the slightest criticism from an administration, especially Republican administration, it goes to Congress. And Congress comes out absolutely, uncritically, unanimously in favor of Israel. And that's, I think, that's the part of the equation that destroys everything else. Because as long as that happens, as that's the situation, Israel can basically do anything it wants to with impunity, because the only show in town is the United States Congress from Israel's point of view.
Well, Jeff Halper, thank you for spending this time with us, and hopefully we'll be talking with you again in the future as these events unfold. And again, I'm William Seaman. This has been a special KBOO Public Affairs feature focused on Israel-Palestine. Thank you for listening.